C. diff infection rates on the rise, a nurse creates a new blog to support her healthcare community, and a nurse is killed in a psych stabbing incident in Australia. Plus, we're going to take a look at stroke care and early management. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's episode here as we continue to roll into the month of January. We have a lot coming up in this show, so I want to remind you that there's a lot of follow-up information to everything discussed in this episode, including all the news items and links to those original stories, as well as follow-up links for the tip of the week. And this week's tip of the week is going to be talking about stroke care. So you can find all of those links and additional resources over at the Nursing Show website, nursingshow.com. You can also check in with us and let me know what you want to hear more of or provide comments on this or any other episode by getting back in touch with me by email. Send those emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from each and every one of you. And in fact, our tip of the week this week and actually over the next few weeks is related to a comment and a question I received from a nurse by the name of Chris, who sent in a question about strokes and hyperglycemia. And so I dug into that a little deeper and for my own knowledge and wanting to be able to answer the question. And I went ahead and decided that it was time for us to do a multi-part series on stroke. So we'll have the first of that series in this episode. And that all came from a listener question. So if you're a viewer watching the show on the video version, perhaps on a Roku box or some other set-top box that you're watching in your living room, or perhaps you're listening to the show via our iTunes feed, whatever the case, you do need to get back in touch with me and let me know what you want to hear more of, questions you might have that I can maybe do some research for you and perhaps bring it together here on a future episode of The Nursing Show. If you want to follow me on any of the social media sites, of course, you can find me under my handle, PodMedic, and you'll find that available at Twitter, twitter.com/PodMedic, also facebook.com/PodMedic. And of course, don't forget the Nursing Show fan page, continuing to grow. We're pushing towards 1,000 fans over there, and you could be among the first 1,000 fans. Visit facebook.com/nursingshow, and then click the like button at the top of the page, and you can become a fan of the Nursing Show. And I post questions and additional articles and links over there that may not appear always on the Nursing Show site. So it's just another way to keep in touch with what's going on here at The Nursing Show. We'll jump into the news items here in just a second. I do want to thank our brand new sponsors, AllNurses.com, which are helping to support the bandwidth costs of sending out thousands of video and audio downloads every month. So thanks to AllNurses.com and Brian Short over there, the founder of All Nurses, for supporting The Nursing Show and the other nursing programs at the ProMed Network. And you can find more and join the nation's largest online community for nurses at allnurses.com. Let's jump on into this week's news items, and I'm going to start off with a story about C. diff. Clostridium difficile, for those of you out there that want the full bacterial name. We know C. diff is a problem in many facilities, although I think a lot of us chalk it up to long-term care facilities and problems. But as we discussed last week in the episode about healthcare-acquired infections, there are a lot of infections that continue to be on the rise and increase, and C. diff is one of them. And I found an interesting article over at CNNHealth.com, and it is an article about hospitalized pediatric patients and the increase of C. diff among the pediatric population specifically, talking about the problems associated with patients who have surgeries, have other infections, opportunistic infections that require them to receive antibiotic treatment, and of course, C. diff responds to the killing off of the beneficial flora and fauna in the body, and responds when there's no of the good bacteria in the bowel and the gut. And so C. diff comes and takes advantage of that situation. And so we have a lot of people that are being put at increased risk for other infections when we treat the infections that they have. It's a nasty cascading situation. But it's an interesting article, and I think, I don't often say this, but I think it's actually one of the more responsible articles on a healthcare issue that I've seen in recent memory. I think it deals with it very frankly. I think it doesn't blow the problem out of proportion, and I think it provides some good support to give parents and other patients the information they need to become involved in their healthcare decision-making process, and also the information they need to support fighting off these types of opportunistic infections. There's a good list of things that you can do to avoid C. diff infections post-surgically or other problems. And so patients that go home, we send them home so quickly after a procedure, they can go home and they can maybe take care of themselves better. So I urge you to follow up on the link in the show notes for this particular article. It's a great story about a girl named Katie who went into the hospital for surgery, ended up being readmitted for a surgical infection, and then ended up almost dying from a C. diff infection. And the story of her family and the awareness that they want to bring about to help people better care for themselves, but also continue to make us in the healthcare community more aware of what we can do to make this whole situation better. And I would urge you to check out this article and, of course, all the other articles, but you might like this one. And there's some good information and resources here that may be available and you want to make available for your patient population so that they can take some additional resources home with them. I think we don't send people home with enough resources. They get bombarded with discharge instructions, and then we send them home. We should send them home with some things to follow up on when they get home and they're settled in and they have a few moments, get on the computer and check out a few websites that you give them and provide them those links or send them links in an email that they can then open up and follow up on after they're home and settled in. They're going to be much more receptive to the learning associated with it than they are when they're thinking about everything else that they have to think about during a discharge procedure. So let's go ahead and think about how we can better provide follow-up care for our patients once they leave our facility. Next up is a neat article about an Arizona nurse by the name of Amy Sellers who has started a new blog. Now, there's a lot of nurse blogs out there, but I like the fact that Amy took the time to make sure that there was a little bit of a press release about her blog. She wants to do more to bring healthcare professionals together. She's an experienced cardiovascular nurse, and I've taken a look at her blog. It's an excellent resource for you, and I'll tell you, you can find it at nursinginfluence.com. So check out Amy's blog and support it and consider starting your own blog. One of the reasons I thought this was a great article is I think there's more that we in the healthcare community can do to continue to get more information out there and provide better information. And supporting a blog either through your facility, maybe gathering a collection of nurses together and going to your facilities administrators, your nursing leaders, and saying, we'd like to start a nursing blog for this hospital and make it a resource for the patients and for the other medical professionals here. And then it's not just one person, it's a group of people contributing on a regular basis. Maybe each of you takes a week and you post one article so that there's four articles a month getting posted. Or maybe you have more people that can post. Maybe the hospital administrator will start getting involved and talking about things. You can have somebody from your billing department talk about common billing questions. You know, yeah, we don't like to talk about the money involved in healthcare, but quite honestly, people have questions all the time. And maybe we can save everybody some time and energy by providing a way that they can get some frequently asked questions answered without having to make a phone call or get a person on the line and actually have some mistakes being made because they didn't understand. So let's do more we can do. And I like what Amy's doing, and I urge you to do this too. There's lots of ways you can start a blog. And you know, if you want to start a blog and talk about what you do in your nursing career, get in touch with me, follow up and get in touch with people like Kim McAllister, Terry Pollack, any of the people on the Insights in Nursing podcast. Almost all of them are bloggers, and they would love to help you because we're nurses. We love to mentor other nurses, so it would be our honor to help you start a blog and share your experiences as a nurse with the rest of the world and the rest of the nursing community, just like Amy did. So check it out, nursinginfluence.com for the new nursing blog on the block, and let Amy know you like her stuff, and hey, let her know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. Finally, a sad story, and I think probably a lot of people have heard about this already, but a psych nurse in Australia was stabbed to death last week. This was a male nurse. He was, I think, 62 years old, was stabbed, and another nurse was injured when a 33-year-old patient instituted an attack. And this is one of those things we don't like to talk about. I don't think it should be... I don't think you should just blow this off and say, well, I'm not a psych nurse. I don't need to worry about patient violence or violence directed towards healthcare professionals. I think this is something that we need to be increasingly aware of and make sure that we're reporting incidents where patients or family members or visitors are violent towards us. It is not something that we can just sweep under the rug and say, well, they were upset because they're sick or they had altered mental status. It doesn't matter. We need to report these incidences. They're causes of injuries, lost workplace time, and by reporting them, we can draw more attention to procedures and practices that can help make us all safer. So I use this as a cautionary tale, not because anyone did anything wrong, but because we need to do more to report and focus on the safety that we need to have in the hospital environment. And I'm very surprised by that. Of course, a lot of you know, originally I was a paramedic and worked in the pre-hospital sector on an ambulance. And it's something that's focused on all the time in the emergency medical services. It's one of the things that we're trained to think about from the minute we walk in the door is scene safety. And we're trained to think that that safety doesn't stop until we're back in our ambulances after dropping the patient off, because we are in an unusual situation. We're with a person we don't know, and we're in their home, we're in the street, then we're in our ambulance alone with someone in a confined space. We should never let our guard down. And I think that just because we're in a hospital facility, when we're in a room with a patient, we should be aware of the body language, of the communication, the nonverbal communication that's going on, and potentially dangerous situations that might occur even in what we would consider a safe environment. So that's my lesson I take away from this. I urge you to read the article, think about it, think about what goes on in your facility. Maybe there needs to be a committee or a commission or a reporting system in your facility to report workplace violence directed at healthcare professionals by patients and visitors so that we can report and start amassing some information. This is something that is not reported nationally. It's not a requirement. Amidst all the other things that hospitals report on, they don't report on safety and attacks against healthcare workers. And perhaps this is something we need to add to the list of things that are reported on a regular basis. It can only help all of us. And again, making us more aware of the problem will help keep us all safer. Check out all the articles in the show notes. Again, nursingshow.com. You'll find a link at the top of the page for the show notes. Click on that link and you'll find the most recent episode listed first and the other episodes as you scroll on down. You can go ahead and find the article and episode you're looking for. Check out the news articles and tip links, all available there at nursingshow.com. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to jump on in to talk about strokes. And we're going to do a brief overview of strokes this week, talk about initial care considerations, and then we're going to spend the next 2 weeks after this talking about different aspects of stroke care. And I think we need to thank listener or viewer Chris, checked in on the email address, and that again is nursingshow@gmail.com. Chris checked in, asked a question about why blood sugar levels and hyperglycemia were so important to be monitored for when dealing with stroke patients. And I kind of thought I might have had the answer, and I ended up doing some more research. And as I was digging in, I said, you know, we haven't done anything on stroke care here on the Nursing Show in a while. And so that's where this series came from. So thanks a lot, Chris, for helping to bring this up. And we'll jump on into that segment now. What are we talking about when we talk about strokes? First off is recognizing the stroke as it before it occurs. And this is also called a brain attack. This is an initiative of the the American Stroke Association, which is related to the American Heart Association. And it is directly related to the fact that we need to start thinking about strokes the way we think about cardiovascular incidents and myocardial infarction. They call them heart attacks. We should call strokes brain attacks. We should think about it in those terms and use the same types of tools and thought process to focus our efforts on those patients. Time is heart muscle. Time is brain cells. And that's basically the way we should be thinking about strokes and brain attacks. So what are strokes? We're going to look at a couple of different things this week. First off, we're going to talk about the stroke. What is a stroke? Definitions and common causes. Also, morbidity and mortality numbers associated with stroke and some of the costs associated. We'll review signs and symptoms. These are going to be review for most of you because we get stroke review every time we renew our CPR, but it is something we should be aware of. And early recognition and treatment are key. So we're going to talk a little bit about some of those factors. And finally, nursing considerations to keep in mind when caring for a stroke patient. Let's start off with talking about strokes or brain attacks. What are they? Well, basically, it's the sudden loss of blood flow to a portion of the brain. It usually is related to a neurological deficit that is defined greater than 24 hours. If it's less than 24 hours, it's considered a transient ischemic attack. And it is those TIAs, those transient ischemic attacks, are basically what we call mini strokes. They are ominous because they often preclude and are precursors to a full stroke. So we should not blow them off and we should educate patients to be treating them seriously. But a stroke itself is considered anything that has a neurological deficit that lasts longer than 24 hours. It can be as a relation to an ischemic stroke, which is caused by a blood clot, and that accounts for about 85% of the strokes seen, or a hemorrhagic stroke, and of course that accounts for the remaining 15%. This could be as a result of an intracerebral or subarachnoid bleed, and of course that additional blood flow into the brain puts pressure on the brain, on the surrounding tissues, and that additional pressure causes ischemia. We also have the transient ischemic attacks. These are those TIAs, those mini strokes. They're self-resolving. Someone will have a sudden stroke symptom, perhaps a left-sided, right-sided weakness, facial drooping, inability to speak clearly, but it clears up on its own. Basically, what's happened here is it's an ischemic stroke where the blood clot has temporarily occluded blood flow to part of the brain, and the body's own clot-busting system has been able to remove the clot, and the clot is resolved on its own, and so the body takes care of the problem on its own. Not a good thing necessarily, because people often ignore these symptoms. They say, oh, it cleared up, I don't need to go to the doctor. However, there's been many studies that have pointed to people that have experienced TIAs have gone on within a short period of time to experience a full-blown stroke. So it's often a precursor and a warning sign that if heated could hold off a full-blown stroke. And that's something to keep in mind, and it's important to understand. What are we talking about statistically? Strokes account for about 795,000 incidents of stroke each year in the United States. 600,000 of those are initial strokes, the first time a person has experienced this type of a symptom and an attack. So there are people who have second and follow-up strokes, and that's a prevention issue. If someone's already had a stroke, they're at increased risk for stroke. We need to and we'll talk about this later, we need to do what we can to hold off and prevent the further stroke that might occur. 6 million people are stroke survivors. So we have those 600,000 initial strokes every year. 6 million people in the population at any given time right now are survivors of stroke. That's a huge number of individuals. And when you think about the disability that is often associated with stroke, that means it's a big portion of the population has some lasting effects of their stroke that require some long-term care and changes in their ability to be independent. 130,000 deaths each year in the U.S. from stroke. So those strokes that aren't recognized quickly or not treated rapidly, or patients who die as a result of the complications associated with their stroke, 130,000 people. It is the third top cause of death following cardiovascular disease and cancer. So a big killer in the United States and indeed worldwide. Now what about disability? Because this is really where I think the nursing care comes into play in the forefront. First of all, because we provide so much care in disability rehab and long-term care facility front. But also because Early recognition and treatment for stroke can greatly reduce the disability associated with stroke long term. And even reducing those numbers by a single percentage point over a period of time can affect thousands of lives. It is the leading cause of disability in the United States. 20% of the people that are disabled due to a stroke. 20% of those people need long-term care. And that means care greater than 3 months. So it's not just rehab to get back on their feet and OT and PT and everything else. These people need extended long-term nursing support care because they are so disabled by their stroke that they need that long-term assistance. 30% of the people that have a stroke become permanently disabled in some way, and that could be a number of different things, but that permanent disability affects their ability to be in the workplace, their ability to live independently. They can't drive anymore, so they put additional stress and strain on their family, and I'm aware of this because I have a parent who's had a stroke, and when my dad lost his ability to drive, it was a stress point for the family because we suddenly had to make ourselves available, and we did, to make sure we got him to where he needed to be, but he also lost the ability to get where he wanted to be on the spur of the moment because he was beholden to other transportation sources. And so it's an issue of frustration and depression for the patients that are suffering these disabilities. The cost adds up to more than $73 billion in healthcare costs, according to the last figures that are in. Those numbers are rising as the population ages and as more people have strokes. We need to do what we can to reduce the long-term effects of stroke, which will reduce the long-term healthcare costs associated with stroke. And again, early recognition is key, what we can do to that. It affects not just the patient, but as I said, it affects the family members and it affects the community. As those healthcare resources are tied up taking care of patients who have strokes, or need additional care for strokes, there are fewer resources available for people who have other healthcare issues. So this is affecting people globally, and not just in the United States, but worldwide. And because some of the risk factors associated with stroke are completely preventable or adjustable, we need to be promoting total health care. Now, there are some things, genetics, gender and racial factors that are all associated with stroke that put you at greater risk that are non-modifiable risk factors. But those modifiable risk factors, hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, all of these things are treatable and preventable. And the more we can do to manage these other long-term chronic health issues, the less likely a patient is to experience a stroke. Let's review the stroke signs and symptoms real quick. Now, I know every time you do a CPR recert, this is included and you're going to recognize these things, but let's go over them again because you should be able to recite these things to people you come in contact with when you talk about stroke care or somebody's asking about a stroke. Educating people as you meet them in your community helps them recognize stroke when someone else experiences a stroke and they can get that person care. Stress to them the importance of calling 911 right away, because the faster we get that patient in to definitive care, if it's a thrombolytic stroke, we can put clot busters in place. We can almost have 100% recovery with rapid response to the stroke early. And so that means we need to activate the system. Sudden numbness or weakness in the face, arm, or leg, especially if it's unilateral. So we know that one-sided weakness or drooping or paralysis we just have those issues. So facial drooping, all of those are important. Sudden confusion, trouble speaking, or trouble understanding someone speaking. There may be vision effects, vision loss associated with it, or blurred vision. It can also be one-sided. Trouble walking, dizziness, loss of balance or coordination. If someone's had a sudden fall and they are not acting normally after you get to them following that fall, it may not be a head injury, or at least the head injury is a result of the fall. The head injury might have occurred before. They might have had a stroke, a brain attack that caused them to fall. So careful assessment is important in understanding all the risk and all the signs and symptoms. A sudden severe headache with no apparent cause. And this is something that's hard to define. You know, you put your finger, if you're going to put your finger on that symptom that people are going to ignore, it's going to be that sudden headache. They're going to say, oh, it's a migraine. Oh, it's this. Oh, it's that. It's a bad headache. I should go lie down. Maybe you should go get checked out. If it's a sudden severe headache out of the blue, with, you know, you didn't have a cold, you don't have a sinus infection, there's nothing else going on that might cause a headache, you should probably get checked out, because a sudden severe headache in a person with other risk factors is an ominous sign. Early recognition is the key, and there's some things that we can use to help assess these patients quickly and be able to monitor the effectiveness of our treatments and their recovery process. So let's talk a little bit about these stroke tools. We're talking about Glasgow Coma Score, and we all talked about GCS. There's been episodes here on the nursing show you can follow up on if you want a review of the Glasgow Coma Score. Cincinnati Stroke Scale is a commonly used assessment tool, quick and easy to administer to determine if somebody's had a stroke, and you can really, it's very effective. Just talking about the Cincinnati Stroke Scale real quick, we're talking about three factors: facial droop, have the patient smile or grimace at you, and look at the evenness. What happens is one side of the mouth comes up and the other side stays still or doesn't come as high. That can be a sign of stroke. Arm drift, you have them hold their hands out in front of them, close their eyes, hold their arms out, palm up, close their eyes, and then tell them to keep their arms level. What you'll see is one arm will drift down while the other one stays steady. That is a sign of weakness. In other words, they don't seem like they're losing any weakness, but one side of their body clearly is not getting the same signals as the other, and that's what we do with arm drift. Speech, have them repeat a common phrase. So the one I've always used and the one I learned is you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So you say to them, hey, repeat after me. Say this: you can't teach an old dog new tricks. They have to repeat what you said, so it's short-term memory. They have to be able to say it clearly, and if their speech is slurred or they're not able to complete the whole sentence or they're confused, that's another sign. So the Cincinnati Stroke Scale, three quick things: facial droop, arm drift, and speech, all can be assessed rather quickly, and it can be used to identify a person who has a stroke. We also have treatments. What are we talking about with treatment? Well, first off, oxygen. We're going to try to oxygenate as much of the brain as possible. So patients that are experiencing ischemic stroke, we might want to consider at least low-flow oxygen for them. Keep their head elevated. We don't want to put any additional pressure on the cranial cavity. So let's go ahead and keep their head elevated in a Fowler's or semi-Fowler's position. They're going to be going in for CT scan, and if we identify that there's not a hemorrhagic stroke and we go through and check them for thrombolytic effectiveness and safety, they're going to be candidate for thrombolytics and possibly, in extreme cases, surgery. So again, rapid recognition is key because we need to get these other permanent interventions, these other interventions that are going to actually fix the problem, on board as soon as possible. You also want to identify the source of the clot if it is an ischemic stroke. And so careful history taking for these patients. What is their history? What medications are they taking? Now, obviously, this is all part of the picture, right? But what we can do to identify these things as soon as possible by getting that history done as completely and thoroughly, asking those questions, trying to figure out, do they have a clot that was thrown as a result of ongoing cardiovascular disease? Do they have untreated hypertension? Do they have a history of pulmonary embolism or blood clots in their legs as well that are throwing clots? All of these things are signs that could be pointing to the source of the clot. If a clot broke off from one location to travel to the brain, it cannot happen again. So we want to make sure that we're doing what we can to stave off and reduce future problems. And we don't want to solve the first stroke only to have another one happen 2 days later. So let's identify that problem. What about tracking treatment outcomes? Now, this is really important. This is that nursing care. The long-term goals for our patients are that they achieve the best possible health that they can. We achieve that by tracking their treatment outcomes. Various scores and scales for tracking these treatment outcomes are available. There's the Rankin or modified Rankin scales, Glasgow Coma Score, and the Glasgow Coma Outcome Scale. Are both important factors. The Barthel Index and the National Institute of Health Stroke Scale which is NIHSS, and I have some resources linked to that in the show notes so you can follow up on that particular one. They're all very important, and I'm not going to go into each of them. They're basically scales that can be used to predict outcomes by identifying the severity of the stroke after the stroke has been resolved. In other words, after we've begun initial treatments for these patients and we're starting to see recovery, how severe was the stroke, and identifying and then tracking that. So using the scale that's going to be in your facility is very important. And that's the first of our nursing considerations. Understand the scoring and assessment scales that are used in your facility. It's very important. Promptly recognize and take action on any essential problems that you see. And this is really important. You know, you're going to have a patient in the hospital for another problem. You need to be able to assess them and understand very rapidly if they have a sudden stroke while in your care. You also need to educate family members for patients that are going home with increased risk factors for stroke. If you're helping a patient who has diabetes and you're educating them about caring for their diabetes, one of the things you should be doing is educating them and their family members on risk factors associated with diabetes and how to recognize a stroke when it occurs. Also, understand same things related to patients that are going home with hypertension and other treatable chronic illnesses. We need to make sure that we're educating them. Regular assessment is important along with early treatment. By assessing patients, we can follow up on how the effectiveness of the treatments are working. We also need to regularly monitor, of course, any patient on thrombolytics. We need to be paying careful attention to their labs and assess them for any side effects, other bleeds that are associated with thrombolytics. If we're putting on clot busters in the body, then they're more at risk for GI bleeds and other complications. So we really need to have a heightened sense of awareness and be assessing the patient, not just for their neurofunction, but for other signs that might be associated with side effects for the treatments for the stroke. 70% of stroke survivors become independent again. That's important to understand. We can have a positive effect by just making 1% of the stroke survivors become independent that aren't becoming independent now through good, high-quality nursing care. That is going to make a big difference in these patients' lives and in their families' lives and their communities at large. So let's get those numbers up. Let's focus on the nursing care needed to get that number to 71 or 72% of stroke survivors becoming and living independently after their stroke and recovery. So let's think about what our nursing care can do to affect these patients positively. Our long-term goals, again, rehabilitation to full health and stroke prevention. We need to educate these patients. They've had a stroke. They are now in another whole class of increased risk factors for another stroke. Obviously, if they've had one stroke and they seem to have had full recovery or near full recovery, we know that there has still been some damage to the brain. Another stroke could proceed to begin that cascade of events that leads patients down a long course of bouts of dementia, increased dementia, and other poor outcomes and health problems. So we need to help prevent other strokes from happening in these patients. And so prevention is part of that rehabilitation and education process. There's a lot of great resources I found, including a couple of great studies in the Critical Care Nursing Quarterly. The American Heart Association has a whole set of guidelines and resources available for stroke care over at their website, and that's stroke.ahajournals.org. Also, the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke has a great set of resources for stroke patients, and also some great community handouts, including video and radio PSAs that you can have put out in your local cable system, on your local radio stations, to educate about stroke care. If you want to do a stroke care and awareness campaign in your community, the government has some great resources for you to do that, and provided for you free or at low cost. So go ahead and follow up on those additional resources in the show notes. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and urge you again to follow up on the additional resources for the tip of the week this week and also the news items available over at nursingshow.com. Follow up. There's a link for the show notes right at the top of the page. You'll find the most recent episode listed first. Then you can scroll down and find other episodes in reverse chronological order. You know, I can cover things in brief detail here and make some comments. It's your job to follow up on the additional resources and understand how these things apply to your own specific nursing practice. So that's your job. I'll try to make sure I get as much of the broad information out there to you as possible, but please make sure you follow up for yourself. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, perhaps you have a suggestion for a future episode, as Chris did, to help spur this week's tip of the week in the next couple of weeks, get a hold of me by sending an email in to nursingshow@gmail.com. I love to hear from each and every one of you, whether you're watching the show on the a TV set box like the Roku, or perhaps watching on our website at nursingshow.tv. Whatever the case may be, it's great to hear from you, and send those emails in, nursingshow@gmail.com. Even corrections, you know, I'm going to go through stuff here and I talk, and sometimes I make mistakes just like everybody else. If I've misspoken in some way or misrepresented something, make sure you let me know so I can correct that information and get it out to the Nursing Show community during the next episode. If you'd like to follow up with me on Twitter or Facebook, you can find me under the handle PodMedic, twitter.com/PodMedic, facebook.com/PodMedic. And again, check out the Nursing Show fan page. Become a fan of the Nursing Show on Facebook, facebook.com/Nursing Show. Just click the like button right there at the top of the page. That's it. We're going to close out with some PodSafe music this week, and I think we'll wrap up the show with a song from a band called American Heartbreak. This is the last of the superheroes, and I think you will like it. It's one of my favorite songs of theirs. I haven't played it here in a long time, and I just was going down my list of PodSafe music that I like and found that song and hadn't listened to it in a while, so we're going to go ahead and throw it out there for you. There's a link in the show notes for their music. If you like what you hear, check it out and let them know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. I'm Jamie Davis. I'll be back again next weekend with another episode of The Nursing Show for you. And in the meantime, please make sure you stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care. We've seen them on TV our whole life. Super Friends were the Rolling Stones, were larger than life. I can be like anyone I see on a record album sleeve. Pistols and the Who, Dolls and Ramones, Don Kirshner on TV. Indeed.